WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Hey, good morning. You are listening to Breakfast Bites, and I am Felicia King. The show that I have for you today is going to talk about some Android vulnerabilities, car hacks, even your insurance dongles might be getting you in trouble, an interesting option for local administrator password solutions, in-private browsing, and some interesting things about Windows 10. So let's roll with that. First, the Stage Fright Android vulnerability. You've probably heard about it now. I did talk about it on the last show, where I was talking about Windows Phone and how Windows Phone is not vulnerable to this sort of a texting hack, at least not at this point in time. This was a specific Android hack. And the main issue that I was focusing on was this time to patch. And this really is an enormous problem. I found it to be such an enormous problem that I just got off of the Android platform altogether. If you can go out and get a black phone, now black phones are like approximately $600 to $650, and then subscribe to the Silent Circle Suite, well, then maybe the Android platform starts making sense for you. Alternatively, what if you were really savvy and you had applied your own Android OS to your phone and you were not utilizing an Android OS that was provided by the cell phone manufacturer? Well, in that circumstance, then yeah, sure, then you can probably keep yourself secure. So I'm looking at the fact that Google themselves have said that they will not release patches for Android operating systems prior to something like 4.2. And when I looked at the statistics on that, there were hundreds of millions of Android devices out there in the world that were still being utilized in production that had those older operating systems. So to me, that's a huge issue. Even if you were to update your phone all by yourself, meaning you'd effectively have to like hack your phone and flash it and put on a whole new operating system, and now you don't have a phone that's supported by your cell phone provider anymore. And I'll just, you know, I realize that 99.9% of you out there, that's not an option for you. And I agree. So unless you're willing to go to that limit, then you don't have access to that as a solution for patching your Android phone. Okay, so if you do get an Android phone and it is supported by the phone provider, the problem is that all the phone providers are taking more than 6 months, typically, in order to release a software update. On the other hand, Apple has been pretty good about staying on top of the updates. And in addition to that, Windows Phone updates come out, as they're available. And I've been very pleased with the security of that. So it comes down more to an issue of taking the cell phone providers out of the mix. If you look at iPhones, Apple themselves, they're directly in control of what security patches you get on your iPhone and your iPad devices. If you look at the Windows Phone, Microsoft is responsible for that. And so they're cutting out the middleman, and it's working out much better, obviously. And so I would encourage you to think about possibly getting onto a different phone platform other than Android, where the Android phone is provided by the cell phone provider. Again, if you went to black phone or you got your own cell phone where you had your own operating system on there, where you were the one who was responsible for flashing that and everything, well, then I think that would work just fine. All right, so let's move on to the car hacking revolution. This is something that I find really exciting because the Black Hat conferences were just over the last couple of weeks, and there was a bunch of them that happened around the world. And it has been several years now since the original car hacking stuff came out. In fact, the two-year gag order has just recently expired on the original White Hat researchers who exposed some Volkswagen vulnerabilities. And because Volkswagen had sued these people to basically put a gag order on them, which I found to be rather irritating, but because that's not really how you solve the problem. What they should have done is just hired these guys and said, you know, hey, we would like you to help us understand how to secure our car. And then they could have put some sort of non-disclosure agreement in the contract for employment. They could have handled it that way as opposed to suing them. It's just so the way that Volkswagen handled that, I just really find to be in alignment with the wrong goals. And I would say their goal was to hush it up as opposed to shed some light on it and take care of the issue. But that's my perspective. Now, these car hacks have really been getting publicized. They're in the forefront of everybody's mind, and there's a lot of them. And I think this is great because it's finally to the point now where the car manufacturers have mechanisms in place to deal with the found vulnerabilities. And it's been recently come to light that Tesla has a phenomenal system for remotely updating cars. And that's a bit of a, you know, double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, if you're somebody who trusts your automobile to be remotely accessible to the manufacturer, then good, because then the, you know, Tesla can actually push an over-the-air update to your automobile. But if you're somebody who does not wish to drive around in a vehicle that could remotely be accessed through that mechanism, which of course a nation state could most definitely access that vehicle through that same mechanism, because they would be able to have a raw man-in-the-middle attack on the data without any ability to inspect that or to understand that that's happening, whether it be from the car provider side or your side. So I see a vulnerability there in terms of if the vehicle is allowed to be remote controlled by any level, then that in itself is a security concern. But it depends on what your level of tolerance and interest is. Hopefully the car manufacturers will just say, well, let's have this as an option. The ideal world, in my mind, is that they would allow you to have selective timing on the over-the-air updates. And what I mean by that is, if you are literally driving the car, then no over-the-air update should be going on at all, like, ever. Like, that whole remote accessibility function, as far as I'm concerned, I would just turn it off while I'm driving the vehicle. Because as long as you're driving the vehicle and you're in it and the car gets hacked, well, you could be dead now. On the other hand, if the car is, you know, parked in your garage and you have to manually hook up a network jack to it or something like that in order to get the update, that would be, to me, that's optimal. I'd just as soon as say, well, I've got to manually hook up my car to a network jack so that I can get the updates to my car. I would rather do that than have it over the air accessible. But that is a, I think that's too, quote, inconvenient for people. So they're not demanding that level of security. And I think we're going to end up with a bunch of cars that are going to continue to be hackable, and people are going to continue to be killed in their cars that got remotely hacked, like Michael Hastings as an example. But on the positive side, there's a lot of interest and a lot of people talking about this and working on this, and that means that it's getting more out in the open and the car manufacturers are having to pay attention to this. So that's good. Of also related interest is the insurance dongles. You know, if you get one of those dongles that plugs into your car and it's from the insurance company and they're supposed to be giving you like an insurance premium discount for safe driving based upon monitoring this, well, it turns out that some Black Hat Conference researchers had specified that, and they actually demonstrated it, that they hacked one of these insurance key fobs and used it to back hack the car and control the systems on the car. And we're not talking about air conditioning and radio here. We're talking about literally the controls of the car, like steering and brakes and accelerator. So that is an enormous problem. And if you have an insurance dongle, you may want to strongly reconsider whether or not you want that thing hooked up to your car. And there's also digital key fobs, specifically from Volkswagen, that have been utilized in order to, again, back hack the car and then take it over while you're driving. Really not cool. As I said, the positive side, though, is that people are paying attention to this, so hopefully we'll get some better forward traction and having all the car companies fix these vulnerabilities and just stop doing silly things in general with regards to poor design out of the box. Let's talk about the local administrator password solution. This is, it's literally what it's called, local administrator password solution. So if you are an IT manager and you happen to be wondering, how can I have a unique local admin password for all of my systems and not have to be thinking about what that password is and storing it in an Excel spreadsheet or something like that? Then I would suggest you go out there and get the local admin password solution. This is a supported tool from Microsoft. There was previously another option that they had proposed some time ago, and it's nowhere as near as functional and cool as this thing is. This thing is actually pretty darn slick. You can have it store the lapse password, so the randomized unique local admin password, literally inside of Active Directory in a field that is accessible only to authorized admins. Very cool stuff. And way better than a situation where one of your systems gets stolen, somebody hacks the local admin password. Of course, if your system was actually encrypted, that would kind of be irrelevant. So, of course, yes, use encryption. But let's say they get that local admin password and you were using that on all of your systems. Well, that is a problem. So, that's what this lapse solution is designed for. And if you are just somebody who does remote desktop to PCs and servers, regardless of whether or not you are an IT manager, I would suggest you take a look at ASG Remote Desktop. This is a tool that I've been using for years, and I was recently talking to some IT managers that I support, and they were just really telling me about how satisfied they are with that solution. And it's called ASG Remote Desktop. It used to be called VRD Remote Desktop, but Vision App was purchased by a company called ASG. And so ASG, of course, has rebranded their product. And frankly, ASG has done a much better job of patching that product. So you can get a free license of it, and that will allow you to control up to three machines simultaneously. If you buy a license for it, then you can, it's unlimited. And I have the unlimited license, and I really prefer it, frankly. So it gives you tabbed view of the machines that you are currently controlling. On the left-hand side, you get a tree view that is categorized based upon, however you want to categorize it. And you can really use it to control, group, manage very efficiently and effectively all kinds of devices that you are controlling with RDP, Remote Desktop Protocol. And it's even possible to utilize a central database that you share amongst a whole bunch of IT admins. So this is pretty slick. And there is a record feature. Now, that does not have audio, but the record feature is really, really handy. I've used it several times. Let's say you've got somebody who says, "Well, how do I do this?" And you can remote desktop into, say, a test virtual machine that you have. So you've RDP'd to a machine where you can simulate the procedure that you wish to train somebody on. And you can do your little record button. And then it will record this video, and then what you do with that video after that point in time is up to you. You could, of course, rip it and publish it to YouTube if you wished. But the fact that it's got this record feature in there is pretty slick, because alternatively, you'd have to get something like Camtasia in order to get a video of your, you know, activities. So ASG Remote Desktop, it's free. That the free version will allow you to control up to three systems simultaneously, which for a lot of people, that's all you need. Let's talk about in private browsing, or private browsing. It depends on the browser that you're using. It depends on what they call it, right? But ultimately, it's all the same concept. It's called private browsing. This works in Google, Firefox, and Internet Explorer, and of course the new browser that's replacing Internet Explorer. And I believe that thing is called Edge, although I haven't tested it yet. But private browsing is a concept that is, you guys may or may not even be aware of it. You may have accidentally used in private browsing at some point in time. So private browsing is intended to be a level of incognito mode, effectively. And when you are using your browser usually, in a non-private browsing methodology, it exposes things like your history. It's retaining that and the history of your searches, what all of your searches were, ranking, cookies, what's your actual browsing cache, what are your active logins, usernames, and passwords, and so forth. Any offline cached website data is stored there, site preferences, and things like that. Now, the problem with that is that that information can, of course, be harvested. There is actually the possibility to cross-harvest between tabs within the same browser, and this is why good standard security practices when you are doing online banking says, don't have a tab open to Yahoo or, you know, anything else, frankly, while you have one tab open to your online banking site. If you're going to do online banking, well, just do your online banking. And then when you're done, then you log off of your online banking site so you no longer have any open session credentials into the online banking site. Then close your browser window. Now, when you close your browser window, you've effectively, assuming that your browser is configured to dump the cache and to dump sessions, when you close the browser at that point in time, then it will do that for you. So if you kind of isolate your activities that way, then you don't have as big of a risk of things like a cross-site scripting attack being able to bridge from one tab or one site that you're at to another tab that you might have over in your other browser window, or I should say in the same browser window. One way to also handle this is just use two browsers. So if you were doing online banking, do it in one browser, and maybe you're looking at Yahoo, put it in the other browser. I still, though, prefer to not utilize that, because what if, right? What if? And it's this whole thing of what if there was a piece of malware that took over your computer, and now it has leaped beyond the browser, and it's looking at all of the active processes that are running on your system. And I have to tell you, this stuff is out there. It is really, really strongly out there. It's a big deal in I am so glad that I have all the layers of security that I have, because there are weeks where I will be looking at a report that I get, and my security systems will be reporting to me that it blocked interesting, dangerous things that I had no idea it was blocking. And when I say I had no idea, As a user experience while I'm browsing the internet and as I'm doing things, I don't get some sort of a pop-up that is telling me that bad doo-doo was blocked. Just the bad doo-doo just gets blocked. And then I get reports on it later. And then I look at, oh, well, that's interesting. And of course, I know what I was up to on my computers, so I can correlate that with what was the activity that I was doing and how does that relate to the bad doo-doo that was blocked. But for people out there that do not have this level of sophistication with their security systems, then what is their experience? Number one, is the stuff getting blocked? Quite possibly not. Do they have any awareness of it? I would really argue no. I've run into a lot of people that don't even have their host-based security product correctly configured to where they think that ignorance is bliss. And while I would agree you don't want your software or your security systems to be all in your face and, you know, popping up and prompting you all the time, there is definitely value in either a daily or a weekly report so that you can have an understanding of what's happening on all of your computers. And maybe it's only 5 computers, but still, maybe it's only 2 computers. I would still think you would want a little report that is telling you, hey, you know, I found this many vulnerabilities, or I found this many bad things and they were successfully blocked, and this is what happened and this is what they were. Yes, I would think you would want that, because ignorance is not bliss in this circumstance. So in private browsing is not something that is designed to help you mitigate the risk of a cross-site scripting attack. It's not designed to mitigate the risk of, you know, banking information getting lost and so forth. What it is it is intended to give you more privacy. And it would be something that you would want to utilize if you are either trying to have a completely different session in a different tab of the same browser, or it would be something that you should be utilizing if you are on somebody else's computer. So let's talk about the first example, which is you need a different credentialed session in the same browser. So let's say on one tab I want to log in as Sally Jones, and then I, on same browser, different tab, and I want to log in as Bob Smith on the other tab. That's what in private browsing can also do for you. You can use it to make it so that you could log into the same website. So on one website you could log in, or on one tab in the same browser, you could log in as sallyjones@gmail.com. And then if your other tab was in private browsing, you could log in as bobsmith@gmail.com. So it's, you could go to the same backend site using different credentials. And that's a really interesting example, because that helps you understand how this in private browsing does credential session isolation, even for the same site. But again, that is not going to make you invulnerable to things like cross-site scripting. So it has some use. If you want to learn about in private browsing, specifically how do you use it for your particular browser of your choice, I would suggest you do some searches on the internet and take a look at some articles about that. And I would like to next talk about Windows 10. What's up with Windows 10? Well, Windows 10 is out. There is the option to do what is called a hot upgrade, meaning if you have an eligible system and you applied for a Windows 10 upgrade, then the possibility exists that you are getting presented an option to do a Windows 10 upgrade. And whether or not you do that is entirely up to you. I don't personally have any problems with Windows 10. I think it's a much more secure operating system. I prefer to not even use Windows 7 anymore, because I just don't think Windows 7 is secure enough anymore. I have been using Windows 8.1 for some time and really appreciating its enhanced security approach in general, and I look forward to demo testing Windows 10, but I haven't had an opportunity to do that yet. What I have done is reached out to my trend partners and asked them, what is your time frame for releasing a trend version of the client that is compatible with Windows 10? And they have already started rolling that out. So if you have an on-premise trend server, you can do an upgrade on that, which will make your agents all Windows 10 compatible. But if you have like Services Edition, then they have promised me that by the end of September, the existing trend agents that you have will have been updated by then, and then they will all be compatible with Windows 10, so we should be able to go forth and do Windows 10 upgrades. And I do plan on doing some testing on the hot upgrade path for Windows 10 at that time. Now, there's something else very interesting about Windows 10 you need to be aware of. As any time you get a new operating system or a new application, you need to be very concerned about configuration settings. And you could say the same thing about your privacy settings in general with regards to LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook or anything like that, even Google. You need to go into privacy settings or configuration settings in general on all the stuff that you have and just look at the settings and make sure that they are consistent with what you desire. So in the case of Windows 10, Microsoft is trying to create a very strongly distributed and resilient patching infrastructure. So they have built a system that purports to actually be secure. That remains yet to be fully vetted, in my opinion, by the public community. But it is what's called peer-to-peer patching. Now, you, as an end owner of your computer, are able to specify whether or not your Windows 10 system will be allowed to be utilized for a peer-to-peer patching methodology for your local subnet only, meaning your local network and your local PCs that are on your local network, or if you want that to be for the internet as well. Now, of course, there's a whole interesting layer here in that there is, you know, good network security design is probably going to block this stuff. And even on the local subnet layer, it very well may block it. And it's not going to be until I actually have this stuff in place on my own network where then I attempt to turn on this setting and watch the traffic that it's doing to find out how is it actually attempting to communicate. Suffice to say, it's intriguing me as well as a number of other security researchers that are out there. There is most definitely an approach by a large number of people where they're saying, well, I'm maybe comfortable with doing peer-to-peer Microsoft updates for Windows 10 across the machines on my own local subnet, but there's no way that I would want my computer to be doing that for PCs on the internet. And even if it is something where the thing is considered to be super, super secure and it can't be back attacked and used as a mechanism to, you know, attack vector your computer to compromise it, it's still going to suck up your network connection and your RAM and processing resources. So is that something that you want to do? I do commend Microsoft for looking for innovative ways to have a globally resilient mechanism for deploying Microsoft updates in a timely fashion. And it's pretty innovative, actually. So it kind of remains to be seen. It was a bit of a shocker. This whole peer-to-peer update thing is a bit of a shocker for us in the security community because there's a whole trust issue associated with that. But it's a very interesting feature, and more to come on that later. I hope you enjoyed the show today. If you would like to give me some feedback or have some questions, please do contact me at breakfastbites@gmail.com.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGT.